Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. Today, what will happen if we take more fiber in than the average American's consuming? We also have to look at acrylamides more carefully. That's what happens when you have the browning of a bagel, or roll, or a bun, or toast. Not good. I'll explain why. Omega-3 fatty acids in combination with vitamin C and vitamin E can help atrial fibrillation. Canines cancer-sniffing snouts showing 90% plus accuracy in detecting cancer before it can even be medically determined a person has cancer. Brain scans show consciousness in vegetative patients. That's something that many of us intuitively thought, but we weren't absolutely certain of. Now there's some scientific basis to that. Also today, from our environmental segment, we're going to take a look at why outdoor schools make kids happier and smarter. And you'll learn about some schools in Germany and Switzerland where the entire classroom all year is outside. That's interesting. This is a commentary for those who believe that there was a noble necessity in the Constitution being framed the way it was by people who, even though many were slave owners and excluded women, and African Americans and Native Americans from owning land or voting, that they had the best interest. I'll share a commentary today that wasn't true. And this is for people who care about real history, not the faux history we've been led to believe. Oligarchy, as American as poisoned apple pie, from Rivera's son, from Truth Out. And also today, the crumbling myths and double standards of the genetically modified biotech sector. Colin Todhunter will talk about stuff that. And then I'm going to start that segment of our special commentaries today with a commentary from Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, about conspiracies. He and I agree upon something. I see conspiracies because we report upon them. In fact, everyone sees the same conspiracies all the time. Why aren't we willing to acknowledge them? We'll have that commentary. Let's begin. I remember doing a debate with the head of the American Medical Association, or top official, on ABC television in Chicago when my first best-selling book came out in 1972. And at that time, the average American was consuming between 3 to 5 grams of fiber a day. 5 at the very high end if you were very health conscious, 3 if you were the average person. I had gone to England to interview 3 people who were experts on fiber, including the man who, Dr. Cleave, who had called it the saccharine disease. And he did so because in the Navy in the Second World War, he was a Navy physician, and he said that as long as they were on land in the tropics, the sailors were healthy. But when they spent extended time on the ocean and were having to eat the food that was mainly canned or baked, they ended up with colon inflammation, constipation, bloating, gas, fatigue, and other problems. So he said we're not eating enough fiber. Then a Dr. John Yutkin also said that we're eating too much sugar. And Yutkin handed me a paper from the British Medical Journal, I believe it was 1903, and in it showed that there was a real concern about the amount of sugar people were consuming because of the conditions they were seeing caused by the sugar. The average amount was 6 pounds a year. And he said now, here we're in the early 1970s, he said, we're consuming over 100 pounds. Now we're consuming over 170 pounds. And yet, most people believe that sugar is not bad. and they think you have to take an enormous amount. Well, if I give you a bowl of sugar and I measure out 40 teaspoons, I say, that's what you're consuming in a day. They say, no way. But then I say, let's take a look at this one cola you just drank. There's 12 teaspoons. And that ice cream and that piece of pie, well, there's another 22 teaspoons. And in that ketchup, and so it goes. So he believed that the sugar in the diet, the lack of whole foods, was a big problem. And then Dr. Burkitt, Burkitt's lymphoma, he discovered Burkitt's lymphoma, he told me that he had visited 67 hospitals in East Africa, and he had never seen any diverticulitis, appendicitis, colorectal cancer, and a heart attack was rare. And he says it's because the people were eating roughage. Now, he didn't say fiber. He said roughage. And I said, well, tell me what you mean. He said, because they're eating millet, the whole grain millet and maize. And what we do is we take that millet or wheat or whatever it is, and we strip off the nutrients. And what you're left with is just the fiber that has no nutrients. He says, they're eating, they're walking, they're exercising, they're lean, and they're healthy. And he said, that's the difference. And he was right. All these men were right. You wouldn't know that by how people consume foods today. This is in the current issue of the British Medical Journal. Quote, an increase in the number of years lived by myocardial infarction, meaning heart attack, survivors who consume a greater amount of fiber. This is from Dr. Lee of Harvard School of Public Health. They looked at 1,840 men involved in the health professional follow-up. These are medical doctors and 2,200 nurses. And they found in those who had had an initial heart attack that the more fiber you consume, the lower your risk of dying from all causes. And I'm thinking that is very important when you consider that right now we're probably consuming, if you're health conscious, around 50 grams a day. Or up to 50, if you're not, probably the around 10 grams. Now, one of the ways that we get our fiber is through rolls, muffins, bagels, toast. Not good. Why? Because in the way that we prepare these foods, they're browned on the outside. There's a chemical that is created when you use high heat on a carbohydrate to brown it, to firm it up. It's called acrylamide. Here's the latest from the Hebei Unit, United University in China. Quote, blood-brain barrier prevents xenobiotics from entering the central nervous system. Growing evidence indicates that neurotoxins, and they mention them, may disrupt the function of the blood-brain barrier. And it goes on to talk about how the acrylamides, in particular, impairs the blood a cerebrospinal fluid barrier function, meaning, in lay language, this was published in Neuroregenerative Research Journal, meaning that the more processed carbohydrates you eat, like a toast, the more likely you are to have toxins enter the brain because the normal blood-brain barrier has been impaired. So it's important to get rid of those. One common side effect of anesthesia is what is called atrial fibrillation, a kind of an irregular heartbeat. This is the Beijing Institute for Heart, Lung, and Blood Vessel Diseases, but they found here's what helps and reduce the impact by 68%. Omega-3 fatty acids in combination with vitamin C and vitamin E. Effective, substantially effective, more than anything else we know of in medicine, and with no side effects. So that is good. And also I saw from the University of Pennsylvania Veterinary School that cancer detection dogs are able to sniff out the odorants that indicate a woman has ovarian cancer, a disease that has no effective tests for early detection. And so here's the issue. Which is better at detecting cancer, a laboratory or a laboratory retriever? And then they had this dog that is able to be accurate 90% of the time. So, my suggestion is that you read up on this, and you understand that the dog has 220 million olfactory cells in their nose, compared to 50 million in humans. And that's why dogs have been used in search and rescue. They can smell. And a growing body of evidence supports the possible use of canines by clinicians. And the largest study ever done on cancer-sniffing dogs found they can detect prostate cancer by smelling urine samples with 98% accuracy. Quote, "Our study demonstrates the use of dogs might represent in the future a real clinical opportunity if used together." Okay, I would agree with that. After all, a lot of people assume they're healthy, assume that they don't have anything growing in their body. An easy way to find out. This is from Natural News, an article published in the British journal The Lancet. Quote, "Researchers from the University of Liege, Belgium, have discovered that a high-tech brain scan can predict which brain-injured patients who appear to be in a vegetative state, hence brain dead, had the best chance of eventually regaining consciousness. Quote, "Our findings suggest that PET imaging can reveal cognitive processes that aren't visible through traditional bedside tests and could substantially complement standard behavioral assessments to identify unresponsive or vegetative patients who have the potential for long-term recovery. Now, the current tests are unreliable. Doctors traditionally distinguish between comatose patients who are in a minimally conscious state and those suffering from unresponsive wakefulness syndrome, or what is called a vegetative state. And in a patient still responding to some stimuli and shows some evidence of awareness, they are generally kept alive. But in a vegetative state, the patient is completely unresponsive, and the chance of recovery are typically been considered very low. Hence, those are the ones that are generally taken off their machines or anything, especially if they have a living will that says, do not resuscitate me. Now, to distinguish between the states, they used the different tests, and they found out that brain scans can show consciousness even when you can't detect it by any other means. Well, from my perspective, that means don't be killing people, don't let them die, because there's a whole lot that we're not aware of, and it could be saving their lives. And there are therapies that the average neurologist and internist are simply not aware of that can be stimulating, including magnetic therapy. 12 million Americans are misdiagnosed by their doctors every year. Quote from Natural News. This was published in the British Journal, the British Medical Journal, Quality and Safety. Medical malpractice is a lot more common than you might think, with a new study out of Texas having recently discovered that at least 1 in 20 patients is misdiagnosed by his or her doctor. That means 12 million Americans are misdiagnosed every year, resulting in potentially harmful medical treatments. This was done at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. And so here's my thoughts on this. If you are given the wrong medication, you're given the wrong test, your test is analyzed incorrectly, if you're put on a regimen that you shouldn't be on, it not only can injure you or cause longer hospital stays, it could kill you. There's a need to completely change the way medicine is done in the United States. It's long overdue. Coconut oil helps remove amyloid plaques from brains of Alzheimer's patients. This is really good news from the Journal of Alzheimer's Disease. That coconut oil may help alleviate the neurodegenerative effects of both Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, and specifically because it impacts, attenuates the effects of amyloid B on cortical neurons in vitro. And it helps shine light on a way that to use coconut oil to reduce amyloid plaques. And one theory concerning Alzheimer's that amyloid plaques built up in the brain In much the same way that plaques can build up in our arteries, causing the neural pathways to be slowed and damaged, entire sections of the brain can start to shut down if these plaques are allowed to grow without intervention. And in a clinical trial involving a medium-chain triglyceride of coconut oil, it was found that users experienced a profound difference after 45 to 90 days of use. It turns out that the coconut oil rescued the amyloid B-treated neurons from mitochondrial damage caused by their toxicity. Coconut oil is also seen to change the circulation of the mitochondria as well. Quote, "The rationale for using coconut oil as a potential Alzheimer's disease therapy is related to the possibility it could be metabolized to ketone bodies that would provide an alternative energy source for neurons and thus compensate for mitochondrial dysfunction." End quote. So, the average cost of Alzheimer's drugs for a month with no effect, positive the person, about $700 minimally. The cost of a month's supply of coconut oil, about $7. And even observing stressful situation can trigger a physical stress response. Now, this is important because the people who think, oh, I'll watch a video or go to a movie, but it's not going to impact me. Yes, it will. The Max Planck Institute for Cognitive and Brain Sciences shows that stress is contagious. Observing another person in a stressful situation can be enough to make our own bodies release the stress hormone cortisol, which I've talked about many times in this program. This is the conclusion researched by scientists involved in a large-scale cooperative project between different institutions around the world, in Germany and other places. Now, we know that being stressed is a major health threat. It causes a range of physiological and psychological problems, burnout, depression, and anxiety. And even those who lead relatively relaxed lives constantly come into contact with stressed individuals. So whether at work or on television, someone is always experiencing stress. And the stress can affect the general environment in a physiological, quantitative way that increased stress hormones, cortisol. So just remember, when you're watching television or you're on the internet, if you're watching something that's stressful, you yourself could become stressed. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a brief break right now. When we come back, we're going to take on some environmental issues and some commentaries. And then I'll ask you to call in and share your thoughts. Our call-in number for TalkBack is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Have you with us, everyone? I'm sure that you have heard many people in the media talk about the founding fathers, what they did to create our nation, and through the efforts working together or challenging each other, came up with our Constitution. What we're never told is, was there another agenda at foot here? According to Rivera's son, there was oligarchs. Now, we know oligarchs today. We heard the term first based upon the 12 Russian oligarchs who gained enormous wealth by having a transfer of public interest to their private interest after the shock doctrine that was orchestrated by Larry Summers and other neocons from the United States. It caused massive suffering in Russia, but a lot of people got very rich. Well, in the United States, we have a lot of oligarchs also. Oligarchs are as American as apple pie. Their wealth and power look very good. Here's what I think we should we examine? American oligarchs, meaning our wealthy elite who use money to buy power, have been around as long as there's been any tradition that they could co-opt. They co-opted a people's revolution, gave themselves vast acres of land in the newly formed nation, and then pull off a coup in 1787 that is commonly referred to as the U.S. Constitution. In the 1770s to 80s, something revolutionary was stirring in the colonies, and it wasn't war. It was a people's movement called democracy. In public meetings and town halls, ordinary citizens were gathered to discuss how to govern themselves. In the Journal of American History, Joyce Appleby wrote, quote, "Foreign visitors in the 18th century invariably commented on the vitality of public discussions and on political confidence of ordinary men." Now, although these ordinary men did not include African Americans, women, and indigenous tribes, these assemblies were not as divided by wealth and class as were the aristocratic governments that gave rise to a culture that was virtually unknown at the time, that of commoners sharing a sense of self-government. And yet after the war, the revolutionary notion of democracy produced a counter-revolution. And this is the history lesson for those who, on the right especially, who don't look carefully enough at the details. The oligarchs of that era found it difficult to conduct business among the 13 sovereign states, each of which was developing its own laws regulating commerce, taxes, and tariffs. The first Constitution of the United States was the Articles of Confederation, and it endured for 10 years, starting in 1778, and before the oligarchs could find a way around it. Even then, they had to resort to extraordinary means. In February of 1787, George Washington, by the way, the richest man in the United States, proposed a convention in May in Philadelphia for the alleged purposes of revising the Articles of Confederation. Upon arrival, however, delegates to the Philadelphia Convention were dismayed to discover that Washington and Madison and Hamilton and others wanted to throw out the old Articles of Confederation. In their place, Hamilton proposed a new second Constitution of the United States, which included a powerful federal government to rule over the state governments, a president for life, a senate for life, an electoral college that elects the president, and an appointment to the Supreme Court, which would have authority over all the state courts. Quote, "Nothing but a permanent body can check the imprudence of democracy," wrote Alexander Hamilton in notes of the secret debates of the Federal Convention of 1787 by Robert Yates. Now, many of the delegates left in protest. Of the 62 delegates appointed, only 39 signed the new Constitution. The Philadelphia Convention, widely heralded today as the birthplace of democracy, was nothing short of an oligarchical coup. Terms for elected officials were a minor concession to the proponents of democracy. The Bill of Rights was tacked on at the insistence of outraged citizens during the process of ratification, but it narrowed the list of protected rights to 10 out of the dozens that were initially proposed. Today, tourists can visit the sunny open rooms I have many times in Liberty Hall. But in 1787, the convention took place under strict secrecy. The doors were closed, the windows blacked out, and security guards ringed the building. In notes of debates in the Federal Convention of 1787, the rules stated, quote, "that nothing spoken in the House be printed or otherwise published or communicated." James Madison, one of the main recorders, refused to publish his notes until all the framers were buried in the grave. If the citizens had known what was transpiring in Philadelphia, it is my belief an uprising reminiscent of the Battle of Seattle at the 1999 World Trade Organization protest might have ensued. In 1787, citizens of 13 sovereign states considered the United States of America to be a description of a friendly alliance of nation-states similar to the United Nations. Under the new Constitution, however, the federal government of the United States became a new, powerful legal body that wielded supreme authority over the subordinate states. When they found out, citizens of the day were not amused. Resistance to the new Constitution was widespread. In 1787, George Washington wrote, quote, "Commotions of this sort, like snowballs, gather strength as they roll. If there is no position that will oppose them, then they will divide and crumble." To ensure the state's ratification of the new Constitution, his colleague Madison, as well as Hamilton, rolled out their propaganda machines. William Grayson of Virginia wrote, quote, "We are now told that we shall have wars and rumors of wars, that every calamity is to attend us, and we shall be ruined and disunited forever unless we adopt this Constitution." And the Carolinians from the South are to come and destroy our cornfields. These, sir, are the mighty dangers which await us if we reject dangers which are merely imaginary and ludicrous in the extreme, end quote. Ultimately, the adoption of the new Constitution came down to money. Like so many of our contemporary issues, the nation divided not down left and right lines, but of moneyed interest, which supported the new federal government, and the populist dissent, which objected to the loss of local power and the rising supremacy of the oligarchs. The anti-federalists were outpowered by the media apparatus and the political influence of the oligarchs, who convinced commercial interests, small landowners, farmers, merchants, and artisans, to side with them. After the states ratified the new Constitution, the proponents of the new system embarked on a long-term effort to alter or recreate the state constitutions and legislative structures to reflect the federal government. So know your history, goes the stern warning. Without knowledge of the past, tyranny in the present continues to oppress us all. To better understand what transpired at Liberty Hall in 1787, imagine that a group of wealthy businessmen came together in secret to draft up a new set of laws and to create a new court system that had authority over the nations of Japan, Australia, Korea, Vietnam, Canada, the United States, and more. Then these wealthy elites empower themselves to regulate commerce to their own advantage. If this sounds uncomfortably familiar, it's because the modern-day Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement has engaged in many of the same maneuvers as the 1787 Philadelphia Convention that established the U.S. Constitution. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is a trade deal that is being negotiated in secret. The legislators of the affected nations are not involved, just as the delegates to the Continental Congress were not present at the Philadelphia Convention. The tribunal courts of the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership would usurp the authority of the courts of the nations, just as the Supreme Court usurped the state courts. Under the Trans-Pacific Partnership, commerce falls under the jurisdiction of the Trade Agreement Board rather than the individual nation states. Local laws that violate the Trans-Pacific Partnership would be considered void, just as state laws were nullified if they conflict with the new powerful federal government. Just as the Trans-Pacific Partnership was initially being fast-tracked through Congress, so did the framers of the Constitution attempt to ram it through the state ratification process. Echoes of the past can be heard in the problems of the present. The revolutionary notion of democracy was put on hiatus in 1787, and the coup of the oligarchs continues to this day. Rule the oligarchs under the empty rhetoric of democracy is so familiar and comfortable that to have millionaires in Congress and billionaires controlling our media and their spokespersons, multimillionaires, and a ruling class wealthy elites seems as American as apple pie. But the poisonous politics of wealth are not the home ground democracy that was cultivated in the backyards of local communities. They are the tainted substitute peddled by wealthy elites. Today, oligarchical rule stands poised to kill equality, justice, and ordinary citizens' quality of life. Our grandmothers all unwittingly crisscrossed the crust, brushed it with oil, and baked it until it was golden. The sweet scent of liberty emits from such well-intentioned efforts, but be careful. Our forks are loaded with false democracy. Your thoughts, please. 888-874-4888. The phrase conspiracy theorist is a derogatory smear phrase thrown at someone in an attempt to paint them as a lunatic. According to Mike Adams, it's a tactic frequently used by modern-day thought police in a desperate attempt to demand, "Don't go there." But let's step back for a rational moment and ask the common-sense question, are they really in a place to say there are no conspiracies in our world? They believe that there are none. You don't hear people on MSNBC and other stations saying, "We'll be right back to cover a major conspiracy." They don't. The Attorney General of South Carolina would surely disagree with such blanket statements. After all, he sued 5 pharmaceutical companies for conducting a price-fixing conspiracy to defraud the state of Medicaid money. Similarly, in 2008, a federal judge rules that 3 pharmaceutical companies artificially marketed up their prices in order to defraud Medicare. In fact, dozens of U.S. states have filed suit against pharmaceutical companies for actions that are conspiracies. Conspiracy to engage in price fixing, conspiracy to bribe doctors, conspiracy to defraud the state, and on. The massive drug company GlaxoSmithKline, even more, pled guilty to a massive criminal fraud case involving the global conspiracy to bribe doctors into prescribing more of their drugs. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. A deeper look into the criminality of just the drug industry alone reveals a widespread pattern of conspiratorial behavior to defraud the public and commit felonies in the name of medicine. As any state or federal prosecutor will gladly tell you, a conspiracy is simply when 2 or more people plot to commit an act of deceit or crime. Thus, when 3 hoodlums plan to rob the local market, they're engaged in a conspiracy and will likely be charged with a conspiracy to commit armed robbery. In addition to the different crimes of armed robbery, the fact that they planned it with several friends makes it a conspiracy worthy of additional felony charges. When these charges are brought up in court, the judge doesn't look at the prosecutor and say, "You're a conspiracy theorist." That would be absurd. The idea, then, that there is no such thing as a conspiracy is flatly ludicrous, and people who condemn others as being conspiracy theorists only make themselves look impaired. To live in our modern world, which is full of collusion and conspiracy, and yet somehow deny the existence of any conspiracies at all, is an admission of a damaged brain. Of course, there are conspiracies, and we people analyze those conspiracies. They are theorizing about what happened. This is, in fact, precisely the job that police detectives and the FBI agents carry out almost daily. Most police detectives are, in reality, conspiracy investigators. There are endless examples of real conspiracies. Auto manufacturers routinely conspire to cover up mechanical defects that put customers' lives at risk. Even National Public Radio lays out the full timeline of the General Motors conspiracy to hide the problem of its faulty ignition switches. Last year, food corporations conspired with the Grocery Manufacturers of America to commit money laundering in Washington in order to funnel money into a campaign to defeat the GMO labeling there. That's what's been alleged. The FDA conspired with a drug manufacturer to keep a deadly diabetes drug called Regulin on the market in the United States even after safety regulators pulled the product in Europe. Similarly, the corrupt criminal-minded operators of the mainstream science journals conspired in particularly vile ways to railroad Dr. Andrew Wakefield with provably false accusations about the nature of his research into the side effects of vaccines. The genetically modified scientist Seralini in his study has been similarly railroaded by genuine conspiracy theorist believers. Fortunately, 150 other scientists have come forward to support Dr. Seralini and his research that GMOs are dangerous. But now he's involved in contrived scientific censorship. We live in a world of such deception and collusion. Frankly stated, it's hard to find a large institution, whether in medicine, war, certainly not at all in national security or in banking, which isn't involved in some sort of conspiracy at some level. Hundreds of thousands of lawsuits have been brought, lost, and settled because of people engaged in regular conspiracy. So what is a conspiracy theorist? The pejorative conspiracy theorist is meant to demean and ridicule skeptics of the official stories. I mentioned repeatedly on this program that there's, in America today, there's only one truth, and that is the official truth. And anything that is not considered official is then no longer given any credibility. And if you challenge the official complaints, then you're called a conspiracy theorist. They're skeptical of the claim that drug companies are really only interested in helping humankind and have no desire to make money. They're skeptical that food corporations are telling them the truth about what's good in their food. And they're also skeptical of anything coming out of Washington, D.C., regardless of which party happens to be in power at the time. People who are not skeptics of official stories tend to be dull-minded. To believe everything these institutions, the official reports tell us, is a sign of, well, is a sign of just lack of intellectual honesty. To ask questions, on the other hand, is a sign of higher wisdom. Skeptics of official stories, it turns out, also have the support of history on their side. How many times has it later been revealed that the American people were lied to by the very institutions we were supposed to trust? For example, it's a historical fact that 98 million Americans were injected with hidden cancer viruses, which were later found in polio vaccines strongly recommended by the CDC. In an effort to cover up and rewrite history, the CDC later scrubbed all accounts of that history from its website, pretending it never happened. But we now know it did happen. That's more than a cover-up. It's an Orwellian-style conspiracy to selectively rewrite history and deny Americans any memory of a monumental, deadly error made by the CDC in collusion with the vaccine industry. According to two former Merck virologists, the company conspired to fake the results of its vaccine tests by spiking test samples with animal antibodies, thereby falsely distorting the results to make the vaccine appear effective. The two virologists filed a False Claims Act with the federal government detailing the conspiracy, saying, quote, Merck also added animal antibodies to blood samples to achieve more favorable test results, though it knew that the human immune system would never produce such antibodies and that the antibodies created a laboratory testing scenario that, quote, did not in any way correspond to or correlate with or represent real life virus neutralization in vaccinated people, end quote. Every month, the Federal Reserve conspires to steal a portion of your wealth through quantitative easing, an irresponsible money creation scheme that devalues all the currency already in circulation. The money the Fed creates is not, surprisingly, handed over to the big Wall Street banks, the same banks that received a jaw-dropping $29 trillion in bailout money since the near collapse in 2008. Or they did hand it over, I should say. Why did this bailout money go to the banks instead of the American people? Because powerful people sat in dark rooms and colluded to send money to the most influential banks. A conspiracy, in other words, by definition. Had those same amounts of money been equally distributed across the United States population, the Federal Reserve would have distributed nearly $100,000 to each and every child in the United States, every man, woman, and child. But instead of enriching the population, the banking bailout burdened the population with the debt now owed to the Fed by future taxpayers. Every $1 trillion created by the Fed, after all, is $1 trillion loan to the U.S. Treasury, which must somehow be repaid. In truth, the minute you start to investigate how money is created by the Federal Reserve, which is a private banking cartel, and why the big banks get all the bailout money, you run headfirst into genuine conspiracies almost from the outset. When you look up the word conspiracy in the dictionary, it should probably say, see banking and finance. In conclusion, the reason conspiracies are real is because humanity is a race capable of extreme deception. As long as there are people whose actions are based upon greed and jealousy and a desire to dominate others, there will be real conspiracies plotted and operating across every sector of society. The correct term for conspiracy theorist should be conspiracy analyst. Most of the people who are skeptical of official stories are in fact analyzing conspiracies in an attempt to understand what really happened and what took place behind closed doors. And that is the way it is. I'm Gary Knoll, and now we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to take a look at your ideas. Please stay with us. 888. Nice to have you with us, everyone. By the way, just a quick program announcement. I hope a lot of you are coming out Saturday to march against Monsanto, and I'll have information a little later on where we're going to be meeting. There's going to be hopefully 5 million people across the world meeting, and in 52 countries and 400 cities. So we're going to let Monsanto know what we think. And in line with that, tonight is the premiere of Seeds of Death, the multi-award-winning documentary that goes against the views and challenges the entire genetic engineering field. You'll see how we lay out and prove conspiracy, who was involved, how they did it. You won't want to miss that. And because it's being done as a fundraiser for BAI, Michael G. Haskins, could you give the number out for people who'd like to call and be a part of that? Michael G. will give that in a moment. And also, I have purchased and set aside tickets for those who may be financially challenged, so you will not be left out. So if you want to come, Michael will give you the two numbers. Michael G.?
212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. That's the number to call, Gary.
Thank you. And you'll get a copy. You'll watch the film. I'll be there. You'll get a copy of the film. And we'll have a panel discussion afterwards. I'm looking forward to it. And if anyone's coming from out of state, let me know when you get there. I always like to acknowledge that. And also, this is my own personal feeling. I'm speaking as an individual, not on behalf or for BAI or Pacifica, but I believe that it's time that someone at Pacifica qualify all of the premiums, because sometimes when I'm listening and I'm hearing people do their pitches, I'm concerned about the claims they're making. I'm concerned about the quality of what they're doing. And I believe it does a disservice to the station and to the listeners. That's all I'll say. Next Monday night, write this down, please. I'm going to be doing a special hour on what I see the future Pacifica and the future BAI to be. It'll be at 8 o'clock. It'll be on the Progressive Radio Network, not on BAI. And I've done an enormous amount of research, hundreds of interviews, looked at thousands of documents, and I believe I have a pretty good idea of what the future is going to be no matter what happens. If you'd like to tune in, you'll just go to progressiveradionetwork.com at 8 o'clock following my regular show. And or you can call on a telephone. You can listen over telephone if you don't have internet. And the number you'll call is 712, write this down now, 712-432-7231, 712-432-7231, and I'll be giving you everything that I know, nothing held back, about what I see happening to BAI and Pacifica in the immediate and foreseeable future. Now, let's say hello to Diane from Queens. Hi, Diane, your turn.
Oh, hello. I'm hoping you can help. I have a daughter, okay? She's in her middle 30s, and she has four small children. Now, she had a baby. It was, like around 7 months old, and getting harassed crazily by these people that lived above, you know, and below, smoking, okay? So, she was under amazing a lot of stress, and she couldn't find another apartment on the first floor. You know, it was really hard to get apartment on the second floor when you had four kids. So she kind of had a nervous breakdown, and she probably had postpartum, you know, whatever. She was put in the hospital and put on a very strong psychiatric drugs. Now, that was like for a month. Then she went home, and she's like slowly weaning herself off them. But she has to move, and she's feeling amazing stress still. Now, she finally weaned herself off, amazing stress, and her heart palpitations and all that. And she's thinking maybe she should stay on them. So I'm asking you, what can she do besides going back on these?
First, she should not wean herself off. That's very dangerous. Some of these psychotropic drugs, you just simply can't wean yourself off. You can't go cold turkey. You have to be under the care of a holistic psychiatrist who can then help you down-regulate the amount over a period of time, and then at the same time, uptake neurotransmitter enhancers and rebalance your brain chemistry, body chemistry, in a way that as one goes up, the other comes down. Generally takes anywhere from 3 months to 6 months. It's not done quickly. All right? That's what I would suggest. Let's say hello from Berkeley, Harvey. Hi, Harvey, your turn.
I have an idea for a new kind of solar. You remember they used to have these guys who go, people who went around selling solar siding. Selling siding, home siding, like aluminum siding and vinyl siding.
Yeah.
Well, now they make photovoltaic ink. That's ink that generates electricity. And I thought maybe putting a photovoltaic surface on that siding, and there's millions and millions of homes that have siding, and they could be photovoltaic siding that generate electricity. Now, solar panels, they make electricity when the sun's overhead, but as the sun rises and sets, there's all that extra amount of time that could be generating electricity. And even though it's not as strong as direct overhead lighting, if you think of millions of homes with solar siding, the amount would be tremendous, and it would be a new source of energy, which so that we won't have to turn to coal, oil, natural gas, and nuclear. So that's it. It would be solar electric siding to generate clean electricity to power up our electric cars and make us energy independent.
Good idea, because there is solar paint now. In fact, I just installed a solar reflective shield for greenhouse that allows 20% to 30% light through, but reflects the rest back, and it's very lightweight, lightest weight I've seen. And also some solar companies now are coming in, and you don't buy the solar equipment. Instead, you lease it, and then what happens is when it's installed, any excess goes into a system that they then benefit from. I don't know all the details, but I'm getting some feedback on it, and I think that's going to be very popular. Thanks a lot, Harvey, from Berkeley. Also from California, Henry. Hi, Henry, your turn.
Talking about the put-down on the conspiracy thing, I can think of AGI, I can think of the Liborn, I can think of Enron, and the latest one is Credit Suisse, and these are all conspiracies. And the sad part about it is that the latest one with Credit Suisse, no person was named.
You are correct. They paid a $2 billion fine. And do you know how much was involved, how much money was out there that they were manipulating concerning the LIBOR? It's the most spectacular financial fraud in history.
Right.
Happened by thousands of people were actually involved in it. Dozens of major corporations were involved in it. It wasn't a secret if you were in those groups. We're looking at trillions of dollars of assets in the LIBOR exchange being manipulated so they could make billions of dollars in net profits for themselves.
At the expense of retirement funds and that sort of thing.
And so the Attorney General says, well, we're going to show you how tough we are. How tough is a person that takes 1/100 of 1% of their profit away and lets them keep everything else, and nobody goes to jail? It is a disgusting. This whole administration and every administration is disgusting. All the body politic is disgusting. You cannot reform something that is metastasized to this level over the body politic of America. You have to have something new and vital and uncorruptible to take its place.
And probably the greatest conspiracy going on right now is the internet, the debacle.
That's correct. And the mergers, the acquisitions, the power plays. This is why I said we've always had oligarchs. We've always had people who've used their resources, unique financial predicament, to control the outcome of their interests. Thank you, Henry. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Phil from New York. Hi, Phil. Your turn.
Hey, Gary?
Yes.
Yeah, hold on 1 second. I just got to shut the truck off. I'm driving. Thanks. You there?
I'm here, Phil.
Okay, first of all, it's a pleasure. I really love your show, and I want to thank you for all your work in every area.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And as far as what's going on, you know, I've always been cosmically minded and lately got, you know, really heavily into the politics of everything because it's really overwhelming, to say the least, which I'm sure you understand.
That's what we deal with every day here.
You know, and my thing is, you know, a war has been declared upon us. You know, as from my perception, it's like an undeclared war. And not just this generation, but all prior generations dealing with this oppressive control and power structure, which is, to me, is ridiculous. And there's got to be a way to eliminate economics altogether and move to a, you know, a higher elevation and a state of enlightenment overall for humanity. Otherwise, we will not survive.
We'll survive. Let's put this in perspective, Phil. We'll always survive, but there'll be a smaller group of people living the lives they choose in safe green zones that have all the resources that the money can provide, but all the rest will be left out of that and will suffer. There'll be people who have unlimited amounts of food and water at their beck and call, and a lot will be searching for water and food. So it's going to be the disparity that we see now will be minor compared to the disparity that's coming. Protest has been so politicized that now any form of protest will be considered a anti-government or anti-corporate attack, and hence you can be prosecuted. And anyone protesting, according to the documents that have been seen from Edward Snowden's release, shows that any peaceful protest in any area is now considered a negative. So we've been living with the idea that we have freedoms, and to a degree we do. But I see that as long as you run counter to the prevailing official establishment, then your views and your standards will not be accepted by them. You have to accept what is given, or you become a victim of it. And even if you accept it, even if you're compliant, as most people are, you will never challenge them. For example, I gave detailed examples of how much we waste, $400 billion on new fighter jets and billions on aircraft carriers. We don't need any of this stuff. We don't need it to become safe, yet private corporations have managed to game the system. And that's how our taxes, you know, go. 56% of all of our tax dollars go to the military-industrial complex. So the average person's not protesting where their taxes go. And so they keep the argument, do we pay our taxes individually or corporately in the right amount? Who's not paying their taxes? Nobody asks, but how is my tax dollar actually spent? Nobody I know, no reasonable person, objects to having taxes paid where there's fairness in the tax structure and the taxes go to what we need that protects us and helps us. To the infrastructures, the roads, the highway, the schools, the dams, the things we need, the ports that help us, parks, rivers, keeping it clean, keeping it safe, keeping our standards high, making sure we have quality education. But that's not where the money goes. So you see, we're not even at the point yet where we can have intelligent discussions, as an American public, individuals certainly can, about what needs changed in our lives. Until we do that, then we just get more of the same. That's why, as long as they excluded Ralph Nader, as long as they excluded Jill Stein and Rocky Anderson and others from their debates, then all the good things that we could be doing now, saving money, helping the environment, limiting global warming, stopping wars, stopping militarization, stop regime change, keep the American child and children around the world safe and well-fed, none of that can happen. None of it will happen. and they keep all the dialogue going on things that are not essential to our well-being. But I'm very concerned that we are not paying enough attention to what we should be. And it's nice to know that you're out there and you are thinking about these things. You've had your epiphany. We all need an epiphany. Thank you very much. We're out of time for this segment. I want to thank you all for joining us and sharing your thoughts. I look forward to seeing a lot of you this evening. Have a nice day. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessi, who's standing by. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. You know, on the same thread of what's happening with this horrible administration, I'm going to read you a statement that then-Senator Barack Obama stated on November 12, 2007. He says, after 7 years of an administration that stretched our military to the breaking point, ignored deplorable conditions at some VA hospitals, and neglected the planning and preparation necessary to care for our returning heroes, Americans, veterans, deserve a president who will fight for them, not just when it's easy or convenient, but every hour of the day for the next 4 years. Well, isn't it interesting? Now we're in 2014, 7 years later, and we have people dying, waiting for a VA appointment. It is horrific. Now, I know you've been fighting for vets since 1991, probably even before that.
Since 1968. When
yeah.
Paul Rudishan and the veterans who were affected by Agent Orange used my radio show on a monthly basis, over 100 shows, to acknowledge that Agent Orange was toxic and caused their adverse health. There were multiple conspiracies to hide that information and to keep the dangerous effect of dioxin and 245T out of the public consciousness from 1991, and showing that Gulf War Syndrome was real, and yet there was a conspiracy in the Veterans Administration not to pay for their help, and so they simply said it doesn't exist. And it did exist, and now we have 900,000 sick vets. We have 900,000 plus homeless vets. So when you look at what's gaining the people's consciousness, it's not when I sent a copy of American Veterans Forgotten Betrayed and three separate documentaries on Gulf War Syndrome to the media, conservative, liberal, all of them, not a single person responded because it wasn't of interest to them. Now they're showing some interest because it's become a news story and it's in a news cycle. And but what about the 2 million people, the homeless vets and the sick vets, who were victims because of this? So that's how it works. And I'm glad to see that at least this is making attention. Now maybe we can look at the other issues as well, focusing on all the other people. One little quick story before we leave. Last night, late at night, I went to see a film down at Lincoln Center called The Immigrants. I didn't like it, but it was a very depressing film about a Polish woman who comes over in the 1920s and is forced into prostitution by some, you know, real low life. And it showed really dire poverty. So I'm walking up the street and I'm thinking about this dire poverty and why we do not engage it. And I walk right by someone. I turned around and I went back, and there's a woman, it's like 1 o'clock in the morning, sitting out in front of Fairway on Broadway at around 74th, with a little sign says, "Help me." So I ask her, "How long have you been on the street?" "Well, many months." "Were you sleeping tonight in the subway?" "Where did you come from?" "I came from Poland." "What did you do in Poland?" "I was a medical doctor." "What else?" "I was a professor of psychiatry." "For how long?" "30 years. And it was interesting because she had one suitcase and her clothes were neat. And you could tell this person had a remarkable sense of dignity, even though she was under extreme negative circumstances. And as it happens, and this is how the universe works, I asked her if I could help her, and she said, "Yes." And I said, "Would you like me to get some food out of the store?" And she said, "I just got some." She said, "I'm here because I can get some juices and some healthy drinks." Well, that's rare to have someone on the street say that. And so someone who I knew came right by, and I introduced them and got the person a place to stay for the evening with this ironically well-known artist. And today I'm going to film her so she can tell her story, see what we can do to get her story out also amongst the thousands others that I have filmed and spoken with and interviewed for this poverty film. It was just so coincidental to have seen the film and then talk with a woman and then have someone who comes from a background, being a professor, a psychiatrist, a physician, and now homeless. So if people think that somehow you're immune from being homeless because of your education and circumstance, you got to come out and see what I'm seeing everywhere. It's everywhere, unless you don't want to see it. And that was the irony. I kept thinking to myself, why aren't we paying attention? So I'll deal with that on an upcoming show.
That's great.
Let's say hello to Eutrice Lead. Hi, Eutrice.
Hello, Gary. Hi, Luann. We were talking about yesterday's midterm runoffs and Nigeria's two crises, Boko Haram's terrorism and President Jonathan's leadership.
Right now on Eutrice Lead.